Okay, it's time for us to begin session number 114. The session is entitled The Challenge of Building a Religious Learning Community. Our primary speaker today is Jeffrey Nielsen. I think many of you will be aware of Jeff because he's had some notoriety, shall we say, in the newspapers the last couple of years for commentary on certain political issues involving the church. He holds a BA from Weber State and holds an MA and is currently a PhD candidate at Boston College in philosophy. He's currently teaching at both Westminster and Utah Valley University, and many of you, I think, will remember that he had been teaching at BYU before certain things became issues. So we're looking very much forward to hearing Jeffrey's comments on this topic. Our respondent this morning, who I think is also well known to many of you because he's the co-chair of the Sunstone Board, is Michael Stevens, who is an associate professor of management and organizational behavior at the Goddard School of Business at Weber State. Michael has just recently relocated to Utah from Texas, and I said to him, well, you've come back to Zion, and he said, no, this is Utah. So we're looking forward to hearing Jeff's presentation and Michael's response, and then hopefully we'll have a little bit of time for discussion with you. Jeffrey, please go ahead.
Well, it's great to be here. Welcome, and I appreciate this chance to come and talk about the challenge of building a religious learning community. I want to take a few minutes to address what that would be to build a religious learning community. I've thought a lot about community and about learning and religion and now trying to put them all together in a way that makes some coherent sense. Now, there's a good thing and a bad thing about this. The good thing is these are new ideas I'm having, so you might be able to get some fresh thinking. The bad news is they are new ideas. They might not be very coherent, and I might be sacrificing you on the altar of my own intellectual curiosity. So if that's the case, I apologize, but I hope it's the former. And maybe Michael can help clarify it at the end if we get to that point. But I do want to talk about a religious learning community and relate it within that context as well to greater honesty in our gospel communications and relationships. And hopefully we'll get to be able to talk about together at least three relations or conversations that would take place within a religious learning community, namely a conversation between a member and a non-member, a conversation between members within the church, within the religious learning community, and then a conversation between church leaders and church members. So those are the three conversations I would like to think a little bit about as we unpack what it means to live in a religious learning community. Now, to begin, though, I want to share with you a couple of presuppositions that I have that lead to a key moral point that kind of lays the foundations for this. The first presupposition is that I believe that within our shared humanity lies both a common need for existential need for meaning, as well as a diversity of individual experience. That is to say that each one of us as human beings possess the same need to live a meaningful life, but the way we understand that and the way we follow that path will differ. So that's presupposition number one. The second presupposition that I have is that only within community can we as human beings live meaningful lives of human flourishing. I think, as I thought about this topic, that the biology of our physical nature makes us social animals. We live in groups. But the self-consciousness of our spiritual existential nature, I think, makes us community animals. As human beings, we don't just want to live in groups, collections of individuals. We want to live in community. And I want to define what I mean by that in just a few minutes. So with those two presuppositions, that we have this shared humanity, this diversity of individual experience, and yet we need one another in community to lead a meaningful life, leads to my key moral point, And that is that I firmly believe that each one of us, as human beings, regardless of our position or place, possess an equal privilege to speak and share an equal and reciprocal obligation to listen. And that's a key moral point for me that I want to get out there. I do that in all of my attempts to talk to groups. I share that idea. But now a disclaimer. I'm enough of a philosopher to know that even though I express that, what I call the peer principle, equal privilege and equal obligation to listen, I express that as a universal truth. I've read enough of Friedrich Nietzsche to know that that's probably just my own personal bias or prejudice coming out. I want to just, because I enjoy this so much, I want to read a bit of one of my favorite passages from Nietzsche where he talks about philosophers like me, and he pokes fun, and I think it's a good thing to poke fun at philosophers. He says in Beyond Good and Evil, and this is my disclaimer for what I'm about to say, so you know that it is only my own personal intuitions that I'm sharing with you. But he goes on to say, and I quote, he says, "What makes one regard philosophers half mistrustfully and half mockingly is not that one again and again detects how innocent they are, how often and how easily they fall into error and go astray, in short, their childishness, but that they display altogether insufficient honesty." That hurts. Philosophers possess insufficient honesty. What does he mean by that? Well, he goes on to say, "While making a mighty and virtuous noise, as soon as the problem of truthfulness and morality are even remotely touched on, they pose," he's talking about me, those like me in philosophy, "they pose as having discovered and attained their insights through pure, detached, logical reasoning." We do pretend that. When in fact, he goes on to say, all they're expressing are their own personal prejudices and biases, which they baptize as truths. I want everybody else to accept as well. So that's my disclaimer, because you should know what I'm about to share with you, though I would like to think it's universal truth, I have to admit to myself, if I'm honest with me and you, it's my own personal intuition and wishful thinking that I'm about to share. That disclaimer also helps me stay in membership in the church. If you make that little disclaimer, you sometimes can be a little bit safer. But I also have to add with that disclaimer that I'm also of the opinion that unexamined belief is not faith. But unexamined belief is superstition. And we need to clear away superstition to make room for real, genuine faith. The problem is that examined belief, though it might be faith, generally doesn't possess the certainty and the necessity and the absolutism that we might desire of it. So those are my disclaimers as I get into talking about a religious learning community. One other thing about my pedagogy, a fancy word for the way I like to teach, and I stole this from my brother who's been teaching fourth grade for many, many years. He's an excellent teacher. And he says that when he teaches, what he wants to do is he wants to tell, then teach, then show, do, and evaluate. So I like that method. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you a few things about how I see religious learning communities. I want to teach a bit about what that might mean, and then I want us to interact, actually, even before we get to the question session, and have you consider with me, interactively, some of these conversations that I talked about and what it would mean to converse within a religious learning community. So with that kind of as the background, let me kind of define for you what I would mean by a religious learning community. And I want to do that by defining the parts. Hold on a sec. I want to make sure I don't spend too much time and not get to the substance. But let me start with defining religion. And I asked my son, who's here on our way down here, how he would define religion. And he actually referred to Joseph Campbell's Myths to Live By. And he said, I think very intelligently, that in one sense, religion might be those sets of stories that we accept that explain the world to us, those stories about creation, redemption, or the fall and redemption. I thought that was a good answer. I want to give more of a functional definition of religion in three ways, as I thought about this. On one hand, religion, I think, is a belief system that's a vehicle within the human community that fulfills three functions. The first one, of course, is the salvific, or the soteriological function, they say in theology. Right, religion, one function of religion is to save us, to redeem us in some way, shape, or form. And that's a key role that religion plays in a belief system. The second thing, the second way I would want to define religion functionally is to say that religion is all about teaching us how to love one another. I mean, the essence of religion really is this idea that we should treat others the way we want to be treated. and that we should love others, including our enemies, in an unconditional way. So those are two important parts of religion, the salvific function, the redemptive function, and the love function. In fact, there's a great story by Hillel, who was a first century Jewish rabbi. You might have heard this before, but a Gentile came to Hillel and he said, "Look, I will convert to Judaism if you can explain to me the essence of Jewish religion, of the Jewish faith, while standing on one foot." You heard this story before? Well, Hillel takes up the challenge. It's the way I've understood it. I hope I can do this. He stood on one foot and he said, "What you would hate if done unto you, do not do to another." And he put his foot down and he said, "That is the entire religion. Everything else is commentary." And I've always liked that idea of treating others the way you would want to be treated, not doing to them what you would hate if done to you. Well, those are two key aspects of religion. The last one I want to share with you is very interesting to me. If you look at the word itself, religion, linguists will tell us that it's composed of two, re and legio, and it means, in essence, re is back, and legio means to bind or to link. So some linguists suggest that the essence of religion, or the meaning of religion, is, and I quote, "to literally, to bind or link us back to the origin." And one of my favorite linguists added to that, he said that religion is to bind us back to the origin in a way that restores the broken symmetry of our shared humanity. Now, I've always liked that. That religion, one of the functions is to bind us together, us humans together, in a way that restores and that unifies our broken symmetry. So that's religion. So let's put it all together and say, for you to consider, that perhaps religion could be the binding or linking of humanity together in redeeming love, where redemption in that sense is understood as healing that broken symmetry of our shared humanity. Now let me quickly talk about learning. And here I'm indebted to a John Patrick, who defined learning in four ways. He said learning should be that thing which encourages dispositions of character. That's one. The second thing he said is that learning should build cognitive skills. The third thing he said is that learning should build or encourage or nurture knowledge skills. And fourth, that learning should build participatory skills. So as I look at learning, in any learning situation, like this one, for instance, it's key to make sure that all four of those elements are somehow touched upon. So by character competencies or character skills, I would understand that learning should somehow include this idea that we each of us individually become morally autonomous ethical agents. Right? That learning should satisfy that function. The second thing would be cognitive skills, which to me means that when you learn, you should learn how to think for yourself. The third thing is knowledge skills. So learning should be, the way I would describe it is you need to learn to be an insatiable and respectful lifelong learner. Knowledge skills. And then participatory skills. That learning should include that idea of learning to think with others. So that's how I would define learning, as a lifelong quest to enhance in yourself and in your community those character competencies, knowledge competencies, cognitive competencies, and participatory competencies. And I'll be coming back to those in a few minutes. Now, finally, community, and then we'll get into the substance of this. I've thought a lot about community, and I've come to define it like this, that community is a place of deep connection between free and equal human beings who choose to live together in order to achieve more meaningful lives. Now, let me repeat that again, because I kind of like that definition of community. A place of deep connection between free and equal human beings who choose to live together in order to achieve more meaningful lives. Now, I hope you've been following this. If I were really a thoughtful teacher, I'd have a PowerPoint, and these would all be defined up here for you. I apologize that that is not the case. If any of you would like to get these definitions from me, I'd be more than happy to supply them for you. But let's put it all together. So what is a religious learning community, having defined those three parts? Well, first off, let me say the final end of a religious learning community would be redemption, that redemptive function. But the instrumental end, and here's a key philosophical point, and again, I apologize for being too philosophical, but an instrumental end is a means or an agent to some end of which it itself is an intrinsic part. Now, if you followed that, you're pretty good. That was pretty complicated. But the instrumental end of a religious learning community is that each member of that community lives a more meaningful life than they otherwise would. And that's accomplished, I would argue, instrumentally through the encouragement and development of character skills, right? Learning to become a morally autonomous ethical agent, cognitive skills, learning to think for oneself, knowledge skills, learning to be an insatiable and respectful lifelong learner, and finally, participatory skills, learning how to think with others. That those four elements would be crucial to the instrumental end of a religious learning community. Now, a few implications, and then we'll get to the teaching part and the interactive part. I believe that some characteristics of a religious learning community would be the following. Number one, it would be dynamic, not static. Number two, a religious learning community would believe that you cannot achieve the final end by abusing or ignoring the instrumental end. After all, whether you're manipulated by good men or bad men, you're still being manipulated. Number three, a religious learning community would view diversity, individuality, and sincere questioning and as assets, not liabilities or threats. The faith of a religious learning community would be trustworthy enough to embrace honest doubt and dissent instead of fearing it and demonizing those who might express it. In a religious learning community, you'd have a safe place where people can be vulnerable, where love, trust, respect, and individuality can flourish, where the contributions and inclinations of all members are respected and taken into account. Number five, in a religious learning community, people can disagree, dissent, question, and doubt gracefully in an understanding and compassionate environment where because someone said so is never thought to be an acceptable and justifiable reason on its own to believe anything. Number six, in a religious learning community, any practice that excludes or negates would be examined, and if it did not expand love, trust, and the boundaries of the community, it would be rejected. And finally, and most importantly, and this is probably the key idea I had as I was preparing to come here today, in a religious learning community, there would exist a sacred covenant relationship between authority and the community. There would exist a sacred covenant relationship between the leaders of the community and the members of the community. And that sacred covenant would include, I would argue, the four following things. One, openness with information that pertains to the function and management of the community. Two, transparency in the use of community resources. Number three, participation in the decision-making affecting the community. And where that's not possible or feasible, the sacred bond between leaders and members would include open and transparent and reasonable justification. Because, as the homespun philosopher Wendell Berry said, to exclude people from the decisions that affect their lives is just wrong. And finally, the fourth element of that sacred bond, that sacred relationship between authority and community, is there would be the possibility of graceful dissent without punishment or intimidation. Now, I think very strongly that those four aspects are absolutely necessary for community, real community, to emerge. Authoritarianism and community cannot inhabit the same space. Rank-based hierarchical leadership and community cannot coexist. And so in a religious learning community, you would have to respect those four parts of that sacred bond between leaders and members, between authority and community. If you don't respect those four things, then you don't have community. You have a pseudo or a fake community. You might have pockets, little islands of authenticity, but overall it wouldn't exist. And that religion would not possess vitality, vibrancy, or growth. So I hope you caught those elements, because I think those are pretty substantial and pretty important. Now on to the teaching part, and then I'll get you involved to wake you up a little bit. I want to go back to those four key elements of learning, the instrumental ends of building a religious learning community. And I want to talk briefly about them and then get you involved in thinking about what conversations might look like in a religious learning community. Let me start off with the character competency, that key aspect that has to be built and nurtured in a learning community. And again, the character competency is where we learn to be morally autonomous, ethical agents. The four parts of that, I think, learning to become a morally autonomous, ethical agent, would be one, to develop conscience, sincerity, integrity, and trust. Now, I'm not going to bother with defining those at the moment for a couple of reasons. One, because there's not time, but secondly, because I think there's some value in having you think of these words for yourself and what they might mean to you. But let me say a few things about conscience, if you don't mind. I like to define conscience in terms of three things. And I'm not talking now about moral conscience as much as intellectual conscience at this point. And I like to break intellectual conscience into three parts, named after three of my favorite philosophers, Socrates, Nietzsche, and Kierkegaard. And let me just briefly read my descriptions of this type of conscience that would be nurtured and developed within the religious learning community. Socratic conscience is to obey the basic human imperative to know thyself. Self-deception, after all, is the basis for mass deception. So the lack of self-knowledge is destructive of community. Socratic conscience recognizes our own fallibility, and it is to believe that an unexamined life is not worth living. This, however, is not a one-time event, but this examined life is a lifetime, a lifelong pursuit. Socratic conscience recognizes that everyday reasoning is usually the expression of prejudices and hidden biases we picked up without much thought. When we quote statistics or authority, or use generalizations without knowing their source or credibility, but claim they are factual anyway, we violate Socratic conscience. Now, Nietzschean conscience. Nietzschean conscience is the courage to examine your own convictions and to realize that our natural habit is to prefer our own beliefs and values uncritically and uncritically privilege them above all others. Nietzschean conscience is to recognize that what we most despise in others tells us more about ourselves than about the others. Nietzschean conscience is to recognize that motivated reasoning will suppress any evidence against it and exaggerate any evidence for it. So it's on the lookout for those natural propensities in us as human beings. Nietzschean conscience recognizes that we tend to overestimate our own contributions and abilities while more accurately assessing the contributions and abilities of others. Nietzschean conscience is to recognize that we judge others by their actions and behaviors, but we judge ourselves by our intentions. And so Nietzschean conscience is on guard for these forms of self-deception. Now, very quickly, Kierkegaardian conscience, hard to say, is to be open and inquisitive. It is to know that we easily spot the errors and inconsistencies in the views of others. It's easy to spot the hypocrisy in someone you don't agree with. But Kierkegaardian conscience realizes that if we're a human being, that we possess the same inconsistencies, the same prejudices, and the same hypocrisies. So Kierkegaardian conscience recognizes that we as human beings always carry this cognitive baggage and is on the lookout and demands intellectual clarity from oneself. So that would be my very quick definition of conscience within the knowledge, or within the character competency. Now, let me quickly move on to the cognitive competency and get you involved. So get ready. You're going to have to participate now. Cognitive competency is learning to think for oneself. And I would just roughly define that as that you learn to be attentive, intelligent, reasonable, and responsible. But as I've thought about cognitive abilities and competencies, becoming attentive and intelligent and reasonable and responsible for your feelings, beliefs, and ideas, I thought about a conversation that might take place, and here's where you're going to have to get involved here. You don't have to come to the mic, just raise your hand and speak it out loudly. But I want you to imagine for a second a conversation within the context of everything that we've just said, or that I've just said. Imagine a conversation between a faithful member of the church and a non-member. In particular, let's imagine a non-member who was once in our community but has now since left it, for whatever reason. Now, here's what I want you to think about, and I'll give you a minute or two, and then I'll want to get your thoughts. But what one question would a faithful member, do you think, want to ask someone who's left the church? And what one question do you think someone who's left the church would want to ask a faithful member who's still in the church? What one question would they each want to ask each other? And then what might possible answers be? I already see a hand up. You're very quick.
My husband and I had this conversation
all
the way up. So.
Did you really? Well, let's give everybody else a chance to catch up. But then we'll start off with you. But think about that for a second. I want to give you a minute to think about this. What one question do you think these individuals would want to ask one another? And what might their possible answers be? So I'll give you just a second, and then I'll get your thoughts. I need that Jeopardy music. Da, 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 da. We moved on to the show and do part, right, of learning. Just a second. I'll get to 30 more seconds, and then we'll get. It's good to see a lot of already people wanting to participate. That's a very comforting thought. Standing up here. Okay, that's probably long enough. I get really nervous waiting. The silence is killing me. But let's come over here. And you wanted to share with us your thoughts? And speak loudly so everybody can hear you. If I move away from this, is that going to be okay?
You should stay close to the mic. Otherwise, the tape won't pick up.
Just the first question a faithful member asking someone who has left the church is, did you ever believe?
Okay.
Did you have that testimony?
And, you're not off the hot spot just yet.
That was the easiest one.
Yeah.
Then I guess the other question would be, can you support my path away from the church and not staying in the church?
Okay.
And the answer is I haven't completed.
Okay, good. Well, maybe someone else might want to speak what those answers might be. So the question would be, did you ever believe? And the other question would be, do you support my path? Okay. Was it Paul?
Joel.
Joel.
The two questions to me would be, why did you leave? Why do you stay?
Yeah.
Okay. Any thoughts on what the answers might be? I'm going to close this door while you're responding.
Actually, I'm going to walk out. See you later. Go ahead, Joe.
Well, it's way too complex. I'll leave that in your capable.
Okay. Oh, I'm not going to try to answer those questions, but thank you. Brent, you had a one?
Yeah, he said it probably better than I did, and simplistic, why did you leave, why did you stay? But my desire is always to know who they are and what they believe and why along those lines.
Okay. Go ahead.
My thought about what the question should be was the same. Why did you stay? And make that a sincere question, not a judgmental question. But the question from the active Mormon is, did someone offend you?
So what might be some possible answers to that question, did someone offend you? Anybody can answer that. Go ahead.
The whole institution offended me.
Yeah, that's...
But that'd be hard to respond to. Yeah. Any other thoughts? So, did someone offend you? What would the person who's left the church want to ask the faithful church member?
I don't know.
Okay.
Other than, my question again would be, why did you leave? Why did you stay?
Yeah. That keeps coming up. Let's think about that for a second in terms of what those questions mean or how they reveal to us whether or not we live in a religious learning community. That's what I want us to think about. But there were some other hands. Go ahead.
Well, my question for both would be, who is God to you and how do you relate to him or her?
Okay. That would be, they would each ask each other that question.
And my experience has been that quite frequently the believing Orthodox Mormon doesn't have a very good, isn't able to separate God from the church very well.
Mm-hmm.
And the sometimes the people who have left aren't able to see God in the church.
Okay.
So those are, but I do think a lot of people think they're having problems with the church where they're really having problems with God.
Okay. There was another hand up over here somewhere. Go ahead. Thank you.
Yeah, it was. This sounds kind of like home teaching, by the way. What
sounds like home teaching?
Going out, you know, visiting with somebody who has disaffected themselves in a situation.
Okay.
And for me, the question is, do you feel safe enough to share your story with me?
Yeah.
And ultimately, I think that's the position I want to be in with that person, if they feel safe enough to do that.
Okay. What do you think the answer would usually be to that question?
Maybe we'll see.
Maybe we'll see? Yeah. William?
I think the strong text underlying everything is, can you still respect and love me regardless?
Mm-hmm.
Either way.
Okay, thank you.
From mother and from last member.
So what do you think I was trying to get at here? And help me out, because I'm not quite sure myself. In having you think about that, those two questions, in terms of a religious learning community, why would it be important for us to be able to have these conversations? And what would be important to characterize those conversations? Thoughts? Thank you. Bishop?
I think it is important. However, in my belief, a lot of people don't ask these questions to their friends and neighbors and even families who they won't teach. But they don't ask them why they've left, because they think it's a taboo subject. My experience has been is that if you go in, even if you have no relationship with those people at all, if you go in and you ask them sincerely and say, I would really like to know what happened. 9 times out of 10, people will generally, if they're asked in a nice way, will be very open and explain to you why what happened.
Yeah.
So I think that we have to have more women teachers that are that upfront and ask, so that we, because just like going to a doctor, you can't.
Right.
The doctor can't help you if he doesn't know where it hurts.
So in a religious learning community, the whole culture and context would be one that supports those types of questions. What I want you to think about is not to judge our present community per se, but to think about what we can begin to do to foster a religious learning community. Did you have another thought?
Yeah, so along what you're saying, I think part of it is for faithful members to think about people who are now non-members as part of the religious learning community, rather than thinking about them as outside of that community.
Fabulous, because remember, if we go back to that one definition of religion, religio, as linking humanity together in that redeeming love to heal that broken symmetry of our shared humanity, then they are a part of that religious learning community. Thank you very much. Well, let's... Oh, Paul. Or Joel. Sorry, I don't know why I want to keep calling you Paul, but... You're Paul.
It seems to me that a community should have an open end. And so the answer of a person who's lapsed, maybe I wasn't offended, but rather those people are able to transcend the forms that lifted them.
Wow, that's profound. Say that again.
Well, I think a community should have an open end, and that there may be people who leave it because they feel they transcend the forms that lifted them.
Okay. Wow. Let's, go ahead, sir.
Building on his statement, it seems to me it's important that if you transcend the forms that lifted you, that doesn't mean you can abandon those forms, because that's where your posterity is living.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So transcend the anthill, yes, is a goal, but the anthill is what made you. It's where your posterity is living.
Yeah.
And if you abandon, how can you be wise and abandon your posterity?
Mm-hmm. Well, let's reframe that to say that in that religious learning community, what's key to my own development is that character. that conscience, that sincerity, that integrity, and that respect upon which we build. There were a couple more thoughts, but I want to transition to the next little exercise when we talk about knowledge competencies. And again, I would define a knowledge competency, and just to remind us where we are here, we're talking about the instrumental ends which build to the final end of a religious learning community, and they I've defined as encouraging character competency, cognitive competency, which we've talked about, and now knowledge competency. And I would define knowledge competency as to learn to be, so you're encouraged within that religious learning community, encouraged to be an insatiable and respectful lifelong learner. So I would define it in four ways, that if you develop your knowledge competency, that you encourage with yourself and others the following four things, that you be curious. So be curious, ask questions, question the answers, and then share would be the four parts I would define as being that knowledge competency, a lifelong insatiable learner. Be curious, ask questions, question the answers, and share. Now here's the next conversation I want us to think about for just a second. Let's imagine a conversation between faithful members in the church. And let's imagine that within a classroom setting, we're talking about how we teach church history and doctrine in the classroom. And let's think about how we might as members talk about what our approach should be to teaching church history and doctrine. And let me just frame this for you in terms of three approaches. And I want you, in fact, I want you with your neighbor to take a couple minutes to think about this as I line it out for you. But approach number one, let's say it's the current use, the current approach to church history and doctrine in the classroom, which, as you know, would be that in the classroom, you only use church-created, approved, and supplied materials, right? You're not encouraged to use anything else. That's approach number one. Approach number two would be to use those church-supplied, created, and supported or approved materials, but encourage the members to do supplementary reading on their own, and if possible, and if useful, bring that into the classroom. That would be second approach. The third approach, way out there perhaps, would be that the church itself supplies to the members of the church, not just the faith-building stories that we presently have, but let's imagine what would happen if the church actually provided materials that gave even dissenting views, or a broader perspective, or more objective views of the nature of church history and the sometimes convoluted way that doctrine emerges. Let's imagine that as a third approach. And I want you to think about the pros and cons of each of those approaches in the classroom of teaching church history and doctrine. So approach number one is the current one. Just use the church-approved and supplied materials. Not encouraged to use any supplementary stuff. Approach number two is to use church-supplied materials but add supplementary stuff that you find on your own. Approach number three would be the church itself would provide us with materials that give you dissenting and different viewpoints. So it's not just the conventional view. Is that more or less clear? So if you would, just turn to your neighbor. If you're not sitting next to a neighbor, you need to get together there. Get with one. And just take a couple of minutes to talk about the pros and cons of each of those approaches, and then I'm going to get some of your feedback. So I'm going to give you some time to do that. So go ahead. I'm going to go to the next slide. some of your thoughts. And again, I really do appreciate you getting so involved and engaged in those conversations.
They don't even want to stop.
Yeah, they don't even want to stop. So, if I could, yeah, my colleagues up here are much more disciplinarian than I am, so we'll get them. Just some thoughts. We don't have a lot of time, but some thoughts from any of the groups on the pros and cons of those three different approaches. Anyone? Go ahead, Brad.
Well, I would think that any one of them would not work for everyone. Some individuals may work better on one side, and other individuals would work better on the other side, and some work best on the other side. Individually, some people like some ways better than others.
Yeah. So each approach might satisfy some, but not others. Well, that's not a very nice place to be in, Brent.
Who you're talking about here, are you talking about the approach that a church, the leadership should take, or say an individual Sunday school
teacher? I'm talking about in the Sunday school, in the seminary, in the institute classroom.
Well, I'm a teacher, in effect. That's what I should... And what should I encourage to use?
Yeah. So within the church, within a religious learning community, which of those approaches or some combination would we use? Now, we can't solve that problem here, but I wanted you to think about it. Go ahead.
B.H. Roberts' course for the 70s in the priesthood years ago was exhaustive in its bibliography. I don't know how much dissenting stuff was in there, but it quoted from ministers of other churches and scholars of a variety of sorts. And as you read it, you weep compared with what's happening.
Right. Well, let's talk about that for just a second, then I've got to move on to give Michael some time. But what might be a reason for this B.H. Roberts view of actually formally supplying to the classroom this broader perspective, not just a completely faith-building one, but one that gets into some of the nitty-gritty of the problems and issues and personalities and less than inspiring behaviors that we find in our history. What might be a benefit of that? Go ahead.
Well, it seems to me that there's a very optimistic assumption that truth is mighty and will prevail, and that the gospel, Mormonism, can stand up against criticism or views from a variety of perspectives. And just the term faith building says faith needs to be built, it needs to be shored up, it needs to be protected. And that's probably true, but is it the only reason for doing that?
Yeah. But, go ahead.
You mentioned earlier Socrates, the unexamined life is not worth living.
Yeah.
You could almost expand it and say the unexamined religion or the unexamined belief system is really not worth having.
Right. Yeah, within that religious learning community, there would have to be the nurturing of that examination. In fact, to just simply want your members to be passive receptacles of conventional wisdom or received truth, I think does not allow them to develop their full potential and their full growth. On the other hand, what might be a con of this? Or go ahead, yes. Yeah.
And for those who have some more experience teaching, who have a broader view or more education, would probably do chafe under that.
Yeah. And I guess I'm getting a sign here to quickly wrap this up, and I wanted to come to the funnest part, but I'll have to skip the funnest part.
No.
But
that's dramatic.
Yes. Again, the point of having you talk about that, again, was to consider the types of conversations that we would have in a religious learning community. We would converse with one another about what or how we should teach and approach and think about our doctrine and our history. Again, so that we're not just passive receptacles, but active participants in that knowledge process. Very quickly, let me wrap this up. Participatory competency, the last part of the instrumental ends of a religious learning community, is learn to think together, to learn to think with others. That would require openness, transparency, respect, and participation. That would require, and I'll wrap up with this and just encourage you to think about something, but we won't do it together. That would require the recognition and respect of that sacred covenant between authority and community I talked about to begin, and I want to end with that because I think that this is so crucial to developing a genuine religious learning community, and that is that that covenant between leaders and members would require that sustaining our leaders is not unquestioning obedience, but sustaining our leaders somehow has to make room for those four requirements, and I'll share those with you again. That sacred bond between leaders and members means that the leaders must be completely open with information pertaining to church, to the community function and management. That the leaders would have to be completely transparent in the use of community resources. The leaders would have to be participatory, which means that there would have to be room for people to participate in the decision-making affecting their community. And where that's not possible, that those who make the decisions would do it in an openly transparent and justifiable way. And finally, and most importantly, but also most problematically, that sacred bond between leaders and members in a religious learning community, that sacred element to sustaining them would somehow have to include the possibility for graceful dissent without punishment or intimidation. Because only if that's recognized can we really have a community. Otherwise, we just have authoritarianism and at times perhaps even religious tyranny. So I would have you think about what that would be like to sustain leaders within the context of that sacred bond that I tried to goofy define. Now, in conclusion, and then I'll make Paul happy and sit down. In conclusion, I believe that only in respecting the instrumental ends of a religious learning community will our intellectual, emotional, and spiritual convictions about gospel truths bear fruit. We live concretely as human beings with other human beings. The church, its institutions, and even the gospel are abstractions. The only thing of intrinsic value is a living thing. Abstractions don't possess value on their own. Their only value comes in how they serve the well-being of concrete, living, breathing human beings. When we sacrifice a person, an individual, for an abstraction, what we're doing is we're sacrificing that person for the well-being of another person who is usually hidden behind the abstraction of position or authority. So it's my preference, going back to the first comment from Nietzsche, my own inclinations, that we create communities in our church where the equal dignity and value of all members is recognized and respected. And the sign of that, I think, would be that in our church, those four competencies, character, knowledge, cognitive, and participatory skills, would be encouraged and nurtured. And the sign of that, I think, would be if we one day come to the point where, in fact, we all recognize and value that peer principle, that each one of us, regardless of our position or title, have an equal privilege to speak and share an equal and reciprocal obligation to listen. So thank you for your participation.
Okay, so where to start? How does one build a religious learning community and have conversations that are open, honest, with an organization with leadership and members who are alcoholics drunk on the elixir of power?
I was trying to be polite.
I've only got 6 minutes. Now, my answer to those of us who are here today and the few who might listen on the tape, we're a fairly select group. We're here through self-selection. We're here at Sunstone, I think, ready to be cheerleaders for this cause of creating and building a religious learning community where open, honest conversations and dialogue take place. However, my response to how do you carry on conversations with these organizational alcoholics may not sit well with those of us here, because my response is physician, heal thyself. What do I mean by that? Well, my experience with most of the conversations that we have when we feel like we're not being listened to is to use the same autocratic, browbeating tactics that are used to silence us. And in the end of the day, what do we have? confrontation, conflict, and the exact antithesis of what we need for this religious learning community, which is an open, safe space where the other person feels like he or she can, in fact, open up and speak honestly and not be browbeaten for what they've said. That occurs only when the other person is convinced that our purpose, our mission, our integrity is to open up conversation that is not judgmental. And so when Jeffrey asked his question, you know, what would the questions look like that were asked in a true religious learning community? I have to reflect and say I rarely ever hear those kinds of questions. I hear questions that sound like that, but more often than not, they're veiled questions with a more controlling, autocratic, one-way message, such that the reality is that the active members talking to the ex-Mormon or the non-Mormon is, in effect, either through tone or through inflection or through reaction, is, what's your problem? And the question more often than not from the non-Mormon, the ex-Mormon, the disaffected Mormon towards the active Mormon is something along the lines of, why are you so naive? Now, what kind of open, safe space does that create for conversations between these two individuals? And my answer, my experience, is that it does not. So what do we do? Well, that's why I say the best place to start is with the person that you're looking at when you're looking in the mirror. Make sure that you embody by word and example the kind of respect and conversation that you want to receive by emulating and modeling that with other people. Now, that's a difficult thing to do when you're under attack, especially when the attack is coming from the institutionalized power brokers of the hierarchy. That's a separate matter. With members, my experience has been that it's much easier to the degree that you begin to master some of these skill sets that Jeffrey's talked about, the character skills, the cognitive skills, the knowledge skills, and I think most importantly, to begin with on this journey of creating an open religious learning community is to learn the participatory skills. Those are actually fairly easy and straightforward to map out, but my experience, because of the emotional intelligence that's required, the most difficult for people to master and to learn. They involve things like confronting with respect. Well, how do you confront with respect somebody who's just, you know, spouted off some blathering nonsense? Well, there are ways of responding, such as, well, that's one point of view. Or to respond with, I'm not sure I follow, even though in fact you may, but a response like that invites the other person to elaborate and share more. If you disagree, if you have a perspective, ideas, thoughts, concepts that you wish to communicate, and the other person is not interested, at that point you really only have three options. To forge ahead and give that gift of knowledge and insight that you have, even though that gift is not wanted, but that is what I would refer to as the intellectual browbeating. And nobody's going to receive that very well. The second alternative is to take your gift and go home and pity the poor fools who didn't want to receive. Neither of those two approaches is constructive or will ultimately lead to this building of a religious learning community where we come together and we commune honestly and openly and genuinely with respect. There's a third alternative, which is rarely ever followed, and that third alternative is to spin up the other person's interest and receptivity in the gift that you have. And that's why I say the best way to do that is to model the kind of respect and listening that you want from them. And when they've had their say, and when they've exhausted their point of view, then it's not a guarantee, but if you've done it well and they feel respected, and they reciprocate that respect, you at least have the chance of getting a shift towards a response from them that is also more open and inviting. Now, there's a lot behind that, I know, but just you know, in the few minutes I have, I wanted to start with that. And you know, as I listen and attend, as I have for years here at Sunstone, over and over and over, we lament about the fact that we tend to have a very one-sided, radicalized conversation between like-minded people. And gee, why don't the you know folks from the more conservative camps come here and participate and all the rest? Well, okay, part of it is because of the you know institutional, informal advice and recommendations of faculty like BYU are given not to come, not to speak, and things of that nature. And so they don't. But at the end of the day, the ones who do venture out are not treated very well here, and their voices are shouted down many times with contempt and disrespect, and they're not into that like few of us are. So we need to do a better job of modeling the respectful conversations that we claim to be about here in our open form of Sunstone. The second issue having to do with leadership, that you know, it is not something at all that we can address in great detail in the few minutes that I have. But one of the things that an idea or thought that has been coming to me over and over and over and over again the last few years is that we as members need to reclaim the law of common consent. We absolutely have to reclaim that law. And if you go to DNC 64, it very clearly tells us that we have an obligation as inhabitants of Zion to police Zion and to make sure that we use that law of common consent to ensure that Zion is being run and led the way the community of Christ understands that it should be, and that we do everything we can respectfully and genuinely and honestly to reject the idea that the law of common consent is nothing more than a loyalty test of members to see if you'll get in line with whatever is being proposed. Now, how do you do that? How do you reclaim the law of common consent? Well, I'm out of time, so we'll have to leave that to the next. Thank you.
Unfortunately, it's true we are out of time. I'm glad that we did have the opportunity to have some interaction with you, and I'm sure Jeffrey would be glad to chat with you further. When Jeffrey sat down, I mentioned to him the thought that came to my mind, and I see Mary Ellen is in the audience, and so I'll just put this out there, because my thought is that this very topic with expanded time would make a wonderful opportunity for a workshop next year where we could take a half a day and really get into this and get a lot more of your kinds of responses. So that's my proposal in conclusion, that next year we do a workshop and we really spend some interactive time on this. Thank you for attending this session.